Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Shares for beginners. Phil Muscatello and FinPods are authorized reps of MoneySherpa. The information in this podcast is general in nature and doesn't take into account your personal situation.
The mission I'm on to spread the word about this way of investing, it's not so much to get people to invest the way I do, but it's to teach them that you can have a framework, you can have a system to look at the numbers and the facts of what's out there and not the stories. Don't get lost in all the noise. And you can put together a portfolio which beats the market. Do it yourself.
G'day and welcome back to Shares for Beginners. I'm Phil Muscatello. What's a fudge factor and how can pulled pork help your stock picking? What's the first rule of investing? I'm always pleased to welcome back to the microphone Tony Kynaston from the QAV Investing Podcast. G'day, Tony.
Hi, Phil. Thanks for inviting me back.
So Tony's average return on his portfolio over his investing career has been double market average thanks to the QAV Investing Checklist system he developed. Now, before we dive into QAV and your zen of choosing shares to buy, I want to pick up on a couple of recent topics from the podcast and specifically greenwashing, which has been a real interesting topic. And it's really to do with super funds as the first court case, isn't it?
Yeah. So the regulator is cracking down on greenwashing and they claim there's been lots of complaints from people saying, hey, I've invested my superannuation with this fund or that fund because of their green credentials, but then I find out they've been investing in oil stocks or coal stocks or pubs or, you know, whatever
gambling.
They don't like.
Yeah.
And I guess that's a point worth making. Everyone's got their own moral red line, so it's going to be different for all people. The regulator's taking action against Mercer over one of these funds, and I guess we should be careful to say that the allegations haven't been proven in court.
They haven't been taken to court yet.
But they are being taken to court. So it's a bit of buy beware with all this. But I think the interesting thing is that there's not that much transparency in the industry. So if you're told it's a green fund, it's very rare that you actually see what stocks are under the hood. And you know, there are
reasons. Would you see that in a super? Surely you'd be able to have, there'd be some sort of transparency, wouldn't there? You'd think.
I haven't been in a super fund for a long time, but because I run my own SMSF, but
you'd have to dig pretty deep, I guess, wouldn't you?
They never disclosed. Yeah. Sometimes they disclose what the top holdings were, but they often just say, "Here's the return on the growth fund. Here's the return on the balance fund, etc., etc." You know, for the quarter or the half or whatever period they're reporting on.
Yeah.
So it is buy beware. There are services out there which will do deep dive research into companies and recommend them or not based on ESG concerns, but that costs a fair bit of money because they're doing a fair bit of work. And then there are people out there who put together an index fund minus a handful of stocks that are obviously of concern to people who are into investing sustainably. And that can be a cheaper way of doing it. And then there are people who are just claiming that they do it and they're not really doing it. And they could probably have their reasons because, as I said, they might decide that one stock isn't suitable, or they might decide that one stock is suitable, but you may have a different perspective. So it's a fairly complex issue. And I personally think the only way to solve it is to be transparent with the holdings in the underlying fund.
And sometimes those funds, the ones that are basically just doing an index fund minus a few, they're charging a bit more in fees as well for basically not a lot of extra work.
That's right. I remember my stockbroker saying it was the greatest business model was to take an index fund and take out six or seven stocks and call it an ESG fund and put the fees up. So
exactly. So in terms of your own investing, you haven't shied away from investing in coal and energy stocks. What are your thoughts on ESG in general in terms of personal investing?
Yeah, well, like I said, I think everyone's got their own red line. For me, it would be like investing. I wouldn't invest in a tobacco company, but there aren't any listed anymore in the Australian market.
But they've got great dividends, haven't they, in America?
Well, that's right. I mean, that's an interesting thing, isn't it? That are you achieving your aims by not investing them? Because the tobacco companies all left the Australian market because of the focus on their their health issues. But they continue to do what they do, and now they don't have anyone looking at them doing it. So it potentially, if you're trying to achieve your outcomes, you've actually made it easier for them to succeed, because they're not getting any sort of transparency and focus that they would get in a listed market. So it's interesting. In terms of coal and energy, I mean, I used to work for an oil company. I know that I'm a supporter of reducing climate change or eliminating climate change if we can and moving to sustainable and green energy, but it's going to take time. And I know the oil industry is too. They want to do it as well. So for me, it comes down to, how does me not buying a share in a coal company actually help climate change? And it doesn't, because somebody else will buy it. And I'm missing out on the returns. And to put some context on it, this may be a temporary situation in the market, but if investors are putting pressure onto the energy sector not to reinvest and develop oil fields or coal mines or whatever, and the banks are having pressure on them to not lend to the companies to do that, then there's less coal and oil in the market. However, we still use as much coal and oil as we always have. So guess what? The price goes up. So it's a basic law of economics that it ignores emotions. So
yeah.
Not only am I not doing anything to help climate change by not buying the stock, I'm also hurting my returns. So that's my position on it. I believe that climate change is best handled by governments and regulators, because the participants have a vested interest in not doing it, so even if they have good intentions.
I think I've just heard recently, sorry, this just popped into my head, there's a carbon credit ETF that's come to market.
Oh, I'm not surprised. Carbon credits, and I think, are about to be legislated at the moment. They are available at the moment, the Australian carbon credits, and so there's a market for them. And companies, I think, under the new legislation proposed, will be obliged to buy them. So it's going to be a large liquid market. And that's a good point, Philip. We're talking about ESG. As I said before, there are companies who will put together what's called a positive ESG fund. So they're only picking the stocks that will positively impact on climate change or biodiversity or whatever the particular issue is, which is a small universe, really. And it requires a lot of deep research to make sure that those companies are doing what they say. And that's different to, as we said, a negative ESG fund, which is removing the stocks, which is a much easier thing to do. And there's something in between. I mean, there are companies out there which, you know, claim that they're doing the right thing from climate change. And the classic example is a big mining company who might have different classes of mines, so iron ore and copper and gold and all those things, and they'll offload their coal mines and say, aren't we great? We've done something for climate change. Well, no, they've sold it to somebody else and the mine's still running. So, I think the regulator's doing a good job to look at all these issues.
And I believe Macquarie Bank is going in boots and alls into renewable energy as well, and a lot of their investments are in renewable energy projects, aren't they?
Yeah, well, there are funds out there and companies out there who do it, and they focus on wind farms, for example. I guess it's a nascent industry and development of solar farms, and I guess also the lithium industry for electric batteries and things like that. So yeah, it is possible to find companies who are doing it. You probably need a bit of help to know, are they only doing that? What else are they doing? And also, too, what I've found is if you're investing in a new industry, it may take a long time to achieve the kind of returns that you want. So it may actually cost you as well. If you're investing for ESG concerns, that's one thing. But if you're investing to beat the market, that's another thing.
Okay, well, let's turn to QAV and the QAV system. Now, you've been on the podcast a few times in the past and explaining it, so we won't go through everything from the basics, including the checklist manifesto, which is a great story. And also, I think one of the episodes that we did, I'm called Why? And it's about why should you own this particular company? Mm-hmm. And it's great to have a reason to own this. You know, a lot of people just go in and they like the idea of something, or they've heard the story of something. And this is really the basics of the QAV methodology that gives you a reason, doesn't it? A reason to believe, as they say.
A reason to believe. Yeah, well, it's based on the numbers rather than the stories, because it's my experience that there's a lot of good stories out there, and the CEOs has a job to try and put their company in the best light.
They're song and dance guys, aren't they?
They're promoters.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. And you'll see a lot of those in nascent industries like wind farms or lithium or whatever. They're all they're all
biotech.
Yeah, they're all out there to change the world. The mining going to be the next big thing and all that kind of stuff. So. Yeah. But how do you test that? Well, you look at their numbers. Well, I guess we're lucky we live in an age where data is easily available, so we can get access to the P&Ls and the balance sheets and the sales of every company on the stock market. We can drop them into Excel and slice and dice. So it's that filtering process and having a checklist and a framework which allows us to score every company, regardless of what their story is or what their prospects are. And come up with a list of stocks to investigate further and to buy.
And the numbers that are input into the spreadsheet are based on company reports, aren't they? But there's only certain numbers in those company reports that you're interested in.
Correct,
and it's all about free cash flow, I believe.
Not free, operating cash flow.
Operating cash flow,
Free cash flow, I think, would probably give a similar sort of result. But I focus on operating cash flow simply because it's the very first thing that's reported in all of those figures and in all of the, well, there's three basic statements that are called a set of accounts. There's the cash flow statement, the P&L, or statement of income as it's now called, and the balance sheet. As you go down through the top to the bottom, the management of the company have more and more latitude to make decisions about how those figures are reported and where they're reported. So, I mean, obviously a sale's a sale and costs are costs, but there is a lot of leeway before you get to the profit line, which allows a management team to put away provisions, for example, to provide for certain circumstances that may or may not happen, to bring them back from the balance sheet if they think that the situation's improved and that boosts profit, nothing else has changed. Depreciation, amortization, the list goes on of all the things that can be decided upon as to where they go, this half or next half or whatever. But cash is king. Cash is cash, and it's very hard to... Well, there's no almost no leeway in reporting that. So I look to cash flow as being one of the main metrics that I report on.
And what are some of the other columns?
Yeah, so we come up with a couple of things called intrinsic values. So that's our valuations for the company. And we tend to use four of different ways of value a company because it's pretty hard to land on the exact number and say this company is worth this down to the last cent. So we kind of produce a heat map based on earnings per share, based on the net assets of the company, the balance, so the balance sheet. So you're either paying for assets or you're paying for earnings, and you're paying for both. So there's valuation metrics. We look at the yield of the company because a lot of companies don't pay yield, and that's not a bad thing. So we don't score them negatively for that. But if a company's paying a yield and it's a reasonable yield, they're going to be loath to reduce it, and it's a sign by management in the company, by the board, that they think that they can sustain this kind of level of profitability. So that's a good thing. We look at whether there's an owner founder in the company. So I find that if the company is still run by someone who founded it, they're incentivized to not lose their life's work and assets, but also too, they're really well established in the industry and know the players and know the turf, and they're probably a better operator than someone who's come in from outside. Because as we said, there's a lot of CEOs who are professional CEOs, I guess I'll call them. And there's nothing wrong with that, but they don't maybe have the 20 or 30 years of experience that a founder has in that particular field. So we're looking at those. We're looking at things like, is the equity in the company consistently increasing for the last 3 years? Is this the lowest PE ratio in the last 3 years? So there's something like about around 20 columns in the spreadsheet that we use to score. And we're scoring for both quality and value, so QAV.
Yeah. And I've noticed that what comes up often are companies at the very, very small end of the market.
Okay. Yeah.
And there's so many interesting stories down there. And
there is.
You sometimes think that's the end of the market where they're all small startups. But some of these companies, I mean, I was just looking because I've interviewed one of the major shareholders in Big River Industries, for example, which is one that you cover quite extensively. And that's been around for 100 years.
No, definitely. And I think that's a bit of an advantage for the retail investor, is if you can find a company that doesn't have a lot of broker coverage because it's on the small side, then you can be the first one in, so to speak, and ride along as it grows and gets discovered. So I've had a couple of those over the years, and it's actually a thrilling ride to watch it happen as it plays out. People need to be aware of liquidity, though, so I tend not to invest in those because my own funds now require me to invest in bigger stocks. But the beauty, again, of the checklist is you can filter it for the size of the company that you want to invest in. You can filter it for all sorts of things. You can do your own ESG filter if you
That's
like
right. If you wanted to have an ESG fund of your own, you just sort of cut out the companies that you don't want to invest in.
Correct. And I guess that's that's the mission I'm on, to spread the word about this way of investing. It's not so much to get people to invest the way I do, but it's to teach them that you can have a framework, you can have a system to look at the numbers and the facts of what's out there and not the stories. Don't get lost in all the noise. And you can put together a portfolio which beats the market. Do it yourself.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Super is one of the most important investments you'll ever make. But how do you know if you're in the best fund for your situation? Head to lifesherpa.com.au to find out more. Life Sherpa, Australia's most affordable online financial advice.
So you used to be a serious investor.
I still am.
Not quite so serious now that Cameron's on the scene. And this is, I'm referring, of course, to the QAV Investing podcast.
Yes.
And there's some terminology which has come along. Josephine, that's pretty self-explanatory, I guess. That, you know.
Don't buy the stock. Not tonight, Josephine.
Yeah, not tonight,
so
Josephine.
It scores well on our list, but the sentiment's against it at the moment.
Yeah.
Yeah. And look, you know, a classic value investor will buy it and then wait for the sentiment to change, and they don't care if the stock price goes down by half and then comes back up, they'll wait. I'd rather put the money to work in something which is going up. So sentiment is a big part of our checklist procedure.
Yeah. Is that part of the three-point trend line?
That's what a three-point trend line is.
You know, okay.
It's our version of using a moving average or a fairly simple technical analysis to tell us when sentiment's going in favour of the stock or going against the stock.
Yep, I love the three-point trend line because I'm a bit of a fan of technical analysis.
Okay. Yep.
But to use that, and we won't go into the details here because we have talked about it, and it's a visual thing as well.
Yeah,
it's
that's a bit hard.
But isn't it? It's just 5 years, monthly chart, monthly time frame, line chart only, no candles.
Right.
Yeah.
Take the highest point, the second highest point, draw a line. If the current price is above that line, it's positive sentiment. Take the lowest point and the second lowest point and draw a line. If the current share price is below that,
I love the zoom out of it. You just get such a view of the stock over a period of time.
Yeah, because in the short term, things move around a lot. But if you look at the five-year monthly, you get a fair idea of the trend.
Yeah. Anyway, back to some of the other factors. Fudge factor.
Fudge factor. Well, this is one that Cameron uses. He likes to tease me about it because sometimes I'll look at a graph and say, okay, it looks like a sell, but I'm going to fudge this one and just hold on for a bit longer and see what happens because it might be just below the sell line and it may go back up again, or it's not the end of the month and it might do better in the future. So I haven't done a fudge for a long time. We've kind of nailed down the rules now to such a degree that we don't have much latitude to fudge. But that's what that is. It's saying, okay, we've got a checklist, we've got all these rules, but you know, this is a bit of a 50-50 one. Let's fudge it and have a look.
Okay. And pulled pork?
Pulled pork is just simply we're pulling apart the company and analysing it. So every week on our QAV show, at least for our subscribers and our club members, we go into detail in one stock and talk about all the numbers, talk about what it does, what the risks are, what the sentiment is, how it scores, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, which is a good way for people to understand how to value a company.
Yeah, correct.
So rule number one. Why is rule number one rule number one, and what is rule number one?
Well, rule number one is a famous Warren Buffett quote. Rule number one is don't lose money. Rule number two is see rule number one. So it's an important thing. So it's basically a 10% stop loss. So if I buy a stock and it drops 10% below the buy price, or even if it goes up for a long time and then comes back to 10% below the buy price and we haven't sold it for some other reason, then I'll sell it. So it's pulling the weeds, I guess. I'd rather, again, take 90% of my capital and go and redeploy it in something which is going up rather than watching something drop.
Because no matter how much analysis you can do, you can just be wrong.
Well, yeah, that's one of the interesting things is that I went back through my numbers and I get about 6 out of 10 right. And I've heard Buffett say he gets about 6 out of 10 right. So not everything we invest in is going to go up. That's just how it works.
Yeah, it's fantasy land. It is fantasy land,
yeah, because the situation changes. Even if the numbers look good, I mean, that's the first thing to know is that we're using history to decide whether a company's good and they're travelling into the future where things might change. So, yeah, it's a 6 out of 10 thing. I think that's a concept you have to get your mind around is that most investing is statistically based. You're putting together a portfolio of stocks and on average you want that portfolio to improve. Not every single case.
And of course, we've both spoken to Simon Shepherd recently and his great quote, the first cut is the cheapest.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's great. Just to have that kind of discipline.
Yeah, pull the weeds and let the flowers bloom.
Yeah. And that can happen pretty quickly as well.
It can, yeah. Mm. So
it's hard psychologically.
I find it useful to set alerts. So I'm just told when to do it and then I do it. And it is hard to do psychologically. Mm. I've been doing it for years, so I get used to it. One of the common questions we get, because we take questions on the QAV podcast from our subscribers, is, I didn't sell when it dropped 10% below my buy price and now it's 30% down. What should I do? So go back in time and sell it when it drops 10%.
That's right. And this can be adjusted as well, the sell price as well, because do you take into account a dividend? Like if you've got it and the share price has dropped by the amount of the dividend, is then your sell price adjusted by that amount?
By the dividend and by the franking credit, depending on what structure you've bought it in, that will have a different value. But we're in dividend season now. The companies have all just reported through February, and then they go ex-dividend and pay their dividends. And so generally when a company goes ex-dividend, the share price will drop by the dividend amount because it's now doesn't have that dividend anymore, so it's worth a bit less. Mm. You don't want to fall into the trap of having it drop and cross one of our sell lines and then about a month later get a check from them and you go, oh, it was a dividend, so I shouldn't have sold. So yeah, so around this time I'm careful. So if it drops and it's a sell, I will check to see if it's ex-dividend, add that back to the share price, and chances are it's above the sell line after doing that.
And we love it when stocks move into an index.
Yes.
This is one of the great things, isn't it?
Well, it means they're going up. Like
and then suddenly everyone else has to start buying it as well. The larger funds have to start
Correct.
Buying it.
Yeah. So in the ASX, there are many indexes and most of them are based on the size of the company. So the market cap. So there's the All Ordinaries, which is most stocks, but not all stocks. ASX 300, 200, 100, 50, 20, etc. And they're rebalanced once a quarter. Again, largely on market cap size. They do have some other issues around liquidity that they will apply to the stock. So like if an owner founder still owns a large portion of the stock, even though the market caps up, the liquidity is the important thing for the indexes. And yeah, so they generally give 2 weeks notice of when they're going to add or subtract something from an index, which gives, if you're eagle-eyed, it gives us a chance and other investors a chance to buy them, because once they do hit the index, then a particular fund manager who has a mandate to only buy the ASX All Ordinaries or the ASX Top 20 or whatever will have to buy them. And so there's buying in the market, and so the price goes up. And the reverse is true, that when if something's added to the top 20, that means one's got to come out, and that the price can go down because of that too. It's an interesting phenomenon and it's been researched, and what I've found as well is that bump lasts for a while, but it doesn't last forever. So once the instos have bought or sold, the price can settle down again to reflect its intrinsic value underneath.
And that bump's not just happening on one day, is it? It can happen over a period of time at different stages, can't it?
Yeah. And sometimes you don't see the bump when it goes into the index because, as I said, people have worked it out beforehand. Mm. And some people even focus on working it out before the index providers make the announcement 2 weeks out. So they know this company's growing and its market cap.
And they can see where the numbers are heading. And there is a good chance that it is going to get into the index. Yeah.
Or the reverse, they can see it's dropping and they'll sell it before it has to be sold by the institutions. Yeah.
So the full QAV club version has been around for a while. Yeah. So what inspired the light version?
We had feedback from members saying, love the doing it myself, love learning the process, but I'm busy. I'm a doctor, a lawyer, I run my own business.
Because it takes a lot of effort and commitment, doesn't it, the full QAV club version?
Yeah, I think it takes a fair bit of effort to learn it. And then the commitment's not as much time. Like I would spend sometimes only 5 minutes, looking at it. It gets a bit busy during company reporting season when there's...
Because that's when all the numbers are being adjusted.
New numbers come out and the stocks tend to move on the new numbers, which makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, companies come out with a good profit and the stock price is going to go up. So a bit of work around that time. But it is commitment. And that's one of the things I tell our listeners when they start the process is you understand you're doing this for the rest of your life. You need that. You can't just do it for 6 months and then go, I'll just leave it for a while and then come back and go, oh, look what's happened to my portfolio. It's like going to the gym. It's a health process, a hygiene process you have to go through. So we decided to start QAV Lite, which is a cheaper option for people. And we run some dummy portfolios because, as we said before about transparency, we like to be fully transparent because it's one thing for me to say, for the last 25 years, I've been getting double market. But, you know, that hasn't been audited or...
Or
out in the public eye. So we started up a dummy portfolio to trade or to invest QAV style about September 2019, so 3.5 years ago. And that's been getting double market or double 2.5 times market since then. Mm-hmm. It's all transparent on our website. And then we also, about a year ago, set up some other dummy portfolio so that if you're a QAV Lite subscriber, you can trade along with us. And so you get an email when we buy something and you get an email when we sell something. And then you can mimic that kind of trade. And, you know, if you miss this one because you were busy, then there's not going to be another one coming along. And the benefit of that is a lot of services tell you what to buy, but they don't tell you when to sell it. And so the fact that you're following along with our process means that we'll tell you when we sell it and you can sell it as well if you choose to.
I'm a new user of Lite myself, and I do realise it is actually not hands-off. It's not completely hands-free, is it? You actually do have to follow and set up alerts for yourself. You've got to make sure that you're across the cell, you know, so that you don't breach rule number one, the most important rule of all. Yeah. There's a lot of work involved in it. Well, actually, it's not a huge amount of work, but you do really have to keep an eye on it, don't you?
Yeah, well, we do have, like, as part of our training procedure, we say if we've recommended something and you didn't get to it for a couple of days and the price is materially different, you've got to be able to track your own rule one price. So again, you might decide just not to buy that stock because you missed it for whatever reason, you went on holidays or whatever. So we encourage people to try and buy as close to our buy price as they can, and then they can use our sell to sell it. But you don't have to, and you can set up your own alerts and you can track your own rule ones if you like. It's just as good.
Yeah, yeah. And how about brokerage? How do you have to factor in the brokerage? Because what kind of size portfolio would you be looking at to make sure that it's meaningful as opposed to the brokerage that you're paying and the costs involved?
Oh, yeah, it's a good question. I don't really know what the minimum size would be. I mean, online brokerage is fairly cheap these days. You can get $10 trades out there, which is what we use in our dummy portfolio factors. I'm at the other end of the spectrum and I use a full service broker and they charge a small percentage on every trade.
Yeah,
so it's along the way. So no, we've got people out there who have probably, there's a few less than $100,000 portfolios out there that we know about. But most of them are $100,000 and up.
Mm-hmm. Wow, it's not my portfolio. And some stocks, especially mining companies and so forth, they're dependent on commodity prices. And, well, I noticed in the Facebook group that there's been a lot of discussion about the price of wheat affecting certain stocks in the...
GrainCorp.
GrainCorp in the portfolio. And what particular metric of the commodity prices to be used. So let's just have a bit of a discussion about how commodity prices do affect the QAV valuation system.
Yeah, so if we can find an underlying commodity for a stock, and generally we find that the stock price of the company tracks the stock price of the commodity, which makes sense if you're a tin miner, you're going to follow the price of tin. Other things can change the stock price of the company because they could be very good at running the tin mine, or they could be merging with another miner, or they could be,
Well, they've got a great deposit of tin.
Yeah, or they could just be about to announce their exploration has hit something. So, so it doesn't always follow one-to-one. But generally, if it's going to be hard for the tin miner to make improving returns if the price of tin is going down. So we use our three-point trend line system to track the underlying commodity. So in that case, tin.
Yeah. And what about GrainCorp in that particular instance? Because, like I said, there's a wheat price, but then there's What are those different wheat prices?
Yeah, so we do have to do a bit of research, and we do it and
this is great, is that people who use are in the club ecosystem, that they're actually looking at these sort of things and discussing it and trying to improve and sharpen the methodology.
Yeah, because, I mean, commodities is a big universe, and there's wheat prices in America and wheat prices in Asia and wheat prices here. So we try and take the relevant wheat price that matches the market that GrainCorp is serving into, which is mainly Asia and Europe. Bit of Europe. So we use sites like Trading Economics to find that particular graph, and then we just watch it every month and track whether the sentiment's going in favour or against that particular commodity. Mm-hmm. And there's a whole universe of stocks out there. You mentioned Big River Industries before, and so their underlying commodity, we think anyway, is timber, because that's what they do. They produce timber products. So again, if lumber isn't selling so well, it's hard for them to put their prices up. So there's commodities in a lot of things out there.
Well, Fortescue is one of the great examples of it.
Correct.
As well.
Iron ore, which has had a great run. It's a classic one for us, because I owned Fortescue Metals, but I sold it when the iron ore price breached its sell line, and the iron ore commodity price was as high as above $130 a ton. It's now back below 100. I think it's around 80, 85 a ton, and that does drive the margins of Fortescue and the other iron ore miners, and you can see that in their stock prices. They tend to track the iron ore price.
So is it that close? Does it relate that close, the price of the
It's never one-to-one, because there's always other things going on. And Fortescue Metals Group now has the Fortescue Future Industries component to it, so there's another leg to it. And if you look at some of the other bigger miners that have more than one type of commodity, you've got to look at what the predominant one is. That's generally the major impact on their share price.
And Fortescue has got a different grade of iron ore to, say, the BHPs or the Rios, doesn't it?
It has a lower grade of iron ore, which can get blended with the higher grades by the electricity provider or even the smelter in some cases, overseas.
Okay, so at this point, we'll put in the plug for the promo code.
Okay.
If you use the promo code SFB, as in SFB for Shares for Beginners, there's discounts available. Now, with the Lite, if you sign up for the Lite plan, you'll get a month free. And if you go for the full club version using that coupon code, you get a 20% discount as well.
Yeah, thanks, Phil. It's we certainly had a lot of people referred to us from Shares for Beginners, so that's great.
Yeah. Well, this is what we've been at a couple of dinners where we've chatted to people who were actually listeners of this podcast and who have been thanking me for being introduced to QAV.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, no, that's it good. Is nice. And that's, we don't want to push it to anyone, consult a financial advisor before making any decisions, but
No, we're not pushing it. We do have the two levels of subscription. We do have discounts via Shares for Beginners, which is great. Come along and have a listen. You can listen to the first half hour for free every week anyway. And there's a trial period as well if you'd like to try it out and decide whether it's for you or it's not for you. And that's an important thing, because everyone invests differently. Some people just don't get the numbers. They'd rather listen to the stories and make their investments thematically. Check it out and see if it's for you.
Tony, thanks very much. It's been great to see you again.
Thanks, Phil. Likewise. It's always good to come around.
And happy birthday.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for listening to Shares for Beginners. You can find more at sharesforbeginners.com. If you enjoy listening, please take a moment to rate or review in your podcast player, or tell a friend who might want to learn more about investing for their future.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.